And, of course, that's the Weavers, If I Had a Hammer. I believe we're joined now by Chris Black. Are you there, Chris?
That's right. How are you doing? Phil, how are you doing?
Very well. And you've written an important article, and I think that the Weavers kind of led us into it nicely because they say they would ring out a warning in your article, NATO's Warsaw Communique. Planning the crime of aggression. Now, you're a defense counsel. You've been in front of international criminal tribunals, but you've taken on the prosecutor's role, and a very important one.
Right.
Now's the time to sound this alarm. Of course, I spoke earlier in the day to someone, Ann Garrison, who attended the Green Party convention, also trying to sound an alarm here about U.S. policies, which could particularly, since nuclear arms are involved, could end ugly for everybody.
Right.
Now,
yes.
Let's go to your indictment. What's this based on? There was a meeting in July, and NATO issued a statement, a communique, on July 8th. And you say that reading that, it's clear that they are preparing crimes of aggression. So let us start right there.
Yeah, NATO had their annual summit in what they call a summit in Warsaw on July 8th and 9th. And on the 9th, they issued a communique, which they do every time they meet. But this one was a very long one, about 150, 60 paragraphs, I can't remember now. Bulk of it concentrated on Russia and Ukraine and Russia's aggression. It was littered with crazy fantasies about Russia's aggression against this country and that country, mm-hmm. and being a danger to Western security and so on and so forth. And that they therefore were going to respond by placing more forces, building up forces on the Russian borders. Western borders in the Baltic in particular, mm-hmm. in Romania with their anti-missile defense systems, mm-hmm. and in Poland. And they craft this communique in such a way that it's almost a diktat to Russia. That is, they say in certain paragraphs that we are willing to work with Russia as long as Russia essentially does what we tell it.
Yes.
And if they do not do what we tell them to do, it's things are going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's not a declaration of war. I don't know what is.
Mm-hmm. Well, and let's go to say there. You cite Article 8 of the Rome Statute,
right?
That they're in violation of. And what is that statute? What does it say?
That's the Rome Statute is the statute which was created to set up the International Criminal Court under the Treaty of Rome. Mm-hmm. And Paragraph 8, they have the crime of aggression in the statute, but it's not active until 2017. And then certain things have to happen for it to be active, like countries approving that.
So they have a little window here, it is.
They have a window, and it may be a long one because maybe mm-hmm. it will never be activated. But Section 8 deals with aggression. 8B deals with aggression.
If you read
the definitions of what constitutes aggression, mm-hmm. The planning and organizing of an aggressive war against a country is a criminal act. It's a conspiracy, mm-hmm. in the sense, mm-hmm. to commit aggression.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's an echo of the Nuremberg, by the way. Isn't this something we've often,
correct.
All of us have been engaged, particularly on the subject of genocide, trying to get to the point that those who commit aggression are responsible for what flows from that aggression.
Right. Yeah, that was the basic principles established at the Nuremberg and the Tokyo tribunals. And they've never been, I mean, they haven't been really enforced, obviously, but that's the state of international law. Mm-hmm. And that is what the definition of aggression is. Therefore, they are committing aggression, and they're conspiring openly to do it.
Yeah.
But the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court right now sits there and does absolutely nothing about it.
Yeah.
And she does have jurisdiction over some of the countries, like Britain and Canada, and Ukraine, because Ukraine wrote a letter twice now to the ICC, giving them jurisdiction for war crimes committed in Ukraine,
mm-hmm.
for instance. So the prosecutor could act, but does nothing, of course.
Yeah.
So I decided to. And my conceit was that I was preparing a prosecution myself.
Well, I really hope that you one day get to do this, actually. I'd like to
see
I'd
love to.
I've seen you defend, but I think I enjoy this prosecution. I rarely do, but enjoy right. prosecutions, but I think it would this one. This is Christopher Black, but the article is in the New Eastern Outlook. That's journal-neo.org, and the title is NATO's Warsaw Communique, Planning the Crime of Aggression. It's a very important article, and you did cite something that I was also glad to see, because I hear this discussed often, and there's a story which President Putin of Russia mentions that they had the discussion when the Warsaw Pact, when the Warsaw Pact was taken apart, but also when Russia met with NATO leaders, and they were promised that there would be no expansion of NATO eastward towards Russia because of national security concerns, and particularly not the introduction of nuclear weapons. I mean, you date it. You have a 1997 NATO-Russia Founding Act in which those things are a little more explicitly stated because, you know, as an anecdote, it always bothers me to hear somebody said, well, they did it on a handshake with Gorbachev, which makes me faint because you're a lawyer. Don't go on handshake.
No.
But NATO-Russia Founding Act, 1997. They did make an agreement. So
yes,
what's happened
did.
To that agreement?
Well, it's being totally ignored. I mean, the Russians keep demanding that they adhere to it, but NATO countries just keep ignoring it. And they've obviously placed their troops as far east as the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, now eastern Ukraine, if unconfirmed reports of Canadian soldiers being in action in Ukraine are true.
Mm-hmm. There's certainly some personnel. We had...
Yes, there's unconfirmed reports
in the Baltics.
Of Canadian casualties there, but...
Now, you also point out that Russia was... There was aggression by Georgia against the Ossetians.
Yes.
And Russia didn't do anything to Georgia, which it could have.
Right.
People
in fact,
forget.
They're developing very good relations with Georgia now because they have a change of government. Russia has been obviously, well, to me and most reasonable observers, I think Russia is trying to, is shocked because they, under Yeltsin and Gorbachev, agreed, okay, we're switching from a socialist system to a capitalist system. Shouldn't that make you happy? And we're going to tell you what, we're going to get rid of the Warsaw defensive buffer zone, which protects us from an invasion by you, on the promise that you won't ever move your forces into that zone and occupy that to threaten us. But that's exactly what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
And the Russians are continually, I think, surprised and dismayed that, well, we're capitalists. Why are you attacking us now?
Yes.
And yeah, obviously they want them to not just be capitalists, but be very compliant ones.
Yeah, they're looking for prisoners, actually.
Prisoners and puppets, and they want their resources cheap. Yes. They don't want to have to pay good money for them.
Yeah, just put this on your ankle and this other thing on your wrist.
Exactly.
They don't like rivals. They certainly don't live like, you know, they want a kind of a zombie international system.
Right. Now they've got resistance from China and Russia, and the fur is starting to fly, and it's getting very dangerous. That's why I wrote the article, one of the reasons, because Putin said that in an interview with some journalists a couple of weeks ago that it's quite clear what's going on, and by placing these anti-missile defense systems in Romania, for instance, and Poland, they're really meant to protect the United States and the West from a retaliatory strike from us if we survive after you hit us first. That's what it's for, to shoot down any remaining missiles we have. So it's an offensive weapon, and that means you're going to do something to us.
Mm-hmm.
So he says it's very dangerous because we might do something first because that's how you're pushing us.
It really needs to be underlined. Your article does that very well. You point out in paragraph 15 of this NATO communique, they say you have to change or there will be no business as usual. And you give a precedent of where they have said that. Yugoslavia,
yes.
Afghanistan,
right.
Iraq. Haiti, by the way, I'm glad you remind us of Haiti, and of course of the removal of Mr. Gbagbo. I recall the Yugoslav issue, and when they threw the gauntlet down to the Milosevic government, they the terms were incredible, and people are forgetting this. Yeah. They said you will have to submit to occupation, right?
Yes. They insisted on the complete occupation of Yugoslavia by NATO troops and the conversion of its socialist system to a capitalist one.
And all of our deep thinkers in the Globe and Star and the New York Times all found that reasonable.
Right.
Which is to say, we don't actually have any deep thinkers. We do have those papers.
It was something they could never comply with. So they said, if we do comply, we're going to bomb you. That's exactly what they did.
And I have to grab this moment to ask you about something. And I think I alerted you to that. I wanted to ask you about apropos of Yugoslavia, because of course President Milosevic was not about to agree to being occupied, and ended up bombed by. And I recall Bill and Hillary were very enthusiastic about that bombing. Now, there's been the trial at the ICC. President Milosevic died before the completion of his trial. Another Serbian was on trial, Mr. Karadzic, and in the judgment in his case, the judges said something apropos of Milosevic. I want you to tell us what that was and what you think the significance of it is.
A lot of people think it's very significant. It's not as significant to me. It is. It is a well brought out by Andy Wilcoxon, who raised it, who caught this, which is worthwhile noting that in the Karadzic judgment in March, they made in a few paragraphs out of 2,000 pages, they referred to Milosevic a few times and said that as opposed to Karadzic, he was the cooler head. He was the more reasonable one. He didn't want to engage in war crimes. He didn't want to. He was always searching for peace. He was always trying to take the reasonable approach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And therefore, he was not supporting any crimes that Karadzic may have been thinking about doing.
And then that there was no joint criminal enterprise, right, between
they said that Milosevic wasn't involved in it.
Yeah. I'm really glad you're talking about it, because there's been some misunderstanding of it. This is, of course, a decision in another case in which they're not judging Milosevic, but they are giving away a bit in passing.
Right. And I think they didn't mean it. They didn't mean it to be – I mean, people are taking it as an exoneration of Milosevic. First of all, my take on that is Milosevic doesn't need exonerating, because he demolished that case in his trial before he died.
Mm-hmm.
And proved that all the charges against him were completely fabricated, these statements that they're now relying on were exposed. Where he revealed them in his trial, and I remember seeing them in news commentary at the time during the events.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all known history. They're repeating it.
Mm-hmm.
I think they didn't want to clear Milosevic's name as such. What they wanted to do was make Karadzic look more of a hothead in comparison to Milosevic.
Yes.
So they wanted to lower Milosevic's role in this case and amplify Karadzic in order to convict him.
Mm-hmm.
So that was why they did it, I think.
Yeah.
But it is important that they did refer to this, so it becomes to the public attention again.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about the Karadzic judgment, which I decided to read it, 2,000 pages, because of this, and see if I could see what else is in it.
Mm-hmm.
What I was shocked by was that in the judgment, there are no references. Hardly any references to a defense,
mm-hmm.
any defense witnesses. There's maybe a handful of defense witnesses, and they're dismissed out of hand. Where they differ from a prosecution witness, they're dismissed because they don't agree with the prosecution witness. Mm-hmm. That's basically their reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no reference at all to any trial transcripts.
Hmm.
All the references are to witness statement. They have a citation, witness statement, witness statement, witness statement. Now, you know from the Rwanda Tribunal judgment,
mm-hmm.
they're pretty good with the judgment is the judges refer to transcript references, transcript here, transcript page there, transcript page there, so you can follow the trial and check these decisions mm-hmm. they've made. But in the Karadzic case, there's nothing.
Hmm.
So it's all they're using witness statements, which it looks like there was no trial. It doesn't look like there was any verbal testimony the way they've got it mm-hmm. crafted. But they just relied on written statements crafted by the prosecution.
Yes.
Which are just NATO propaganda tracks used and fed to witnesses they have to learn, as we know from the Rwanda Tribunal.
Yeah.
And so the judgment's just a litany of prosecution witness statements. And that's the judgment.
Makes writing a judgment a lot easier, doesn't it?
It's like they sat in a room and wrote it based on these witness statements, which are just to be used, you know, for defense disclosure and preparing the witness.
Mm-hmm.
But I see no references, or almost none, to the trial transcripts. I have no idea, since I was at that trial, if there actually were any witnesses appearing, aside from a few experts they rely on.
Yeah.
It's not even a judgment. It's not worth the paper it's written on, but anyway.
It really shows, by the way, and apropos of your article, you were dealing with fairly cynical bodies who, this is all sort of, somebody's been assigned to add footnotes to an obscure text. They just paste something in there to say that we did the right thing. This is Christopher Black we're speaking with, and the article is NATO's Warsaw Communique, Planning the Crime of Aggression, and it's in New Eastern Outlook. That's journal-neo.org. And I want to ask you, returning to this theme about all the aggression that we've already seen recorded by those who are now giving Russia a hard time, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Aristide, Bagbo, Libya. You come to paragraph 35 in their communique, and they have the phrase, the readiness action plan.
Yes.
Missiles in Poland.
Right.
Which leads us, if you don't mind repeating, I know you spoke of this before, but and they have this, I always hate these awkward military kind of terms, a forward deployed. Forward deployed.
Yeah.
We're talking missiles and nuclear warheads.
Nuclear warheads in Europe.
Yeah. Tell us about the forward-deployed brilliant caper. Right.
Well, we know they've sent increased numbers of troops. Now Canada has a battalion somewhere in the Baltic. And on top of their troops in the Ukraine now. But they're also, so they're forward deploying, that is moving their forces and logistics up towards the Russian border with every month. So they're placing depots, arms depots, logistics systems and communication systems and defense intelligence systems. They're setting all these structures up in these exercises they're continually conducting. And they're rotating people in and out, but they're all getting practiced in these drills for something.
Mm-hmm.
But they're now talking about, openly talking about placing nuclear weapons in these countries. Now, there's nuclear weapons, say, in Germany, the Americans have there, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're talking about moving them up, tactical and strategic nuclear weapons, up to the borders of Russia, in the Baltic and these other countries. And that would be a complete violation of the Foundation Act and... It's a violation of the UN Charter. I mean, it's just hostile action preparing for a major nuclear war. There's no other reason they'd be moved up, except to be used at some point.
Well,
so that's what's dangerous, because this building and building, and you have now the Russia, the Americans confronting China, and the Chinese coming to a conclusion where we have to stop these American ships coming in. There's going to be some firing, or they get trod on. So it's very tense.
This is... The demonization process works to just hypnotize everyone. I'm sure you're as impressed as I am that there's no one on his feet in the Canadian Parliament asking any questions like, is it possible we get our hair singed doing this? Will we have anything left after should we make a mistake?
Well, they're being led.
No debate, nothing.
I wrote to the Minister of Defense a couple of months back asking him what the justification was for sending our troops overseas in these missions, and particularly Syria at that time. And I got back an answer. It was very polite, but it was very just evasive and vague. They relied on, I said it was illegal under the National Defense Act to send troops overseas, unless it's under a NATO mission or a UN mission. They wangled around that and said they have a royal prerogative to be able to do that, which means, well, we can do anything we want. It doesn't matter what the law is, which is illegal. And then they gave factually wrong. Then they said, well, we're doing it because of this and this and that, which was the American propaganda version of what the world is, not reality. So either we're being run by idiots or mouthpieces for the United States or, well, obviously we are.
I'm going to go for the
second. No reasonable person can come to these
conclusions. I'm going with the second.
Right.
We've been speaking to Christopher Black, New Eastern Outlook, journal-neo.org, in the great article, NATO's Warsaw Communique, Planning the Crime of Aggression. And it's something everybody should read, everybody should be talking about. Chris recommends a People's Tribunal, and I think that actually at the moment I can't think of a better solution, Chris. That's the only, what are we, right. We're going to have to rely on the people, I'm afraid.
I'd like to be prosecutor. You can be my investigator.
I'm happy to do
my
it.
My president.
Really. Yeah, I'm happy to do it. Well, Chris Black, thank you very, very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye. It's Christopher Black, and it is a very important article. When you have people like President Putin saying what he has said, and you read these communiques, you know you better be alert. And start with this article. I want to just mention, I noticed that President Obama has pardoned 250 individuals in the United States using his presidential power to do that. There is a name. We must not forget Leonard Peltier. Canadians should not forget Leonard Peltier was arrested in Alberta on the say-so of an affidavit by one individual who then was defined by a court as incompetent. So Canada turned over Leonard Peltier, who's been in prison ever since, approximately, I'm going to guess, 40 years. I don't know. It's been a long time. Leonard Peltier was involved with the wounded knee issue. And many people have begged that he be released, at least as a gesture to Native Americans who have already suffered all these years. But Obama, I notice, has not said a word about him. So Canada has some responsibility. We turned him over. Honey, thank you very, very much. And this is Taylor Report. See you next week. Hi, this is Phil Taylor, host of CIUT Friday Morning. Every Friday morning between 9 a.m. and 10 a.m., we have film reviews and interviews by Daniel Garber, our film critic, theater reviews and interviews by Lynn Slotkin, our theater critic and passionate playgoer, and a deeper look at classical music by Philip Conlon. We also discuss the headlines affecting our world. CIUT Friday Morning, we give voice to radio that matters to you. CIUT 89.5 FM, the new sound of your city.